ladies and gentlemen, it is a Friday. Oh, my God. Thank goodness it is a Friday. But it is a Friday, and we have one of our absolute favorites on today, Neil Morrison. He is actually, it's Friday at 6 o'clock in the UK, and Neil, showing his dedication to the craft, his sheer dedication to HR, he is on with us to kind of break some things down. We, of course, could talk English football the entire time. We will not do that, though, because I think most of the audience would be absolutely bored stiff. But we're going to have a fantastic call today. I want to thank everybody for listening. And so while we can, Neil, do us a favor and introduce yourself to the audience.
Okay. So I guess I kind of have two separate things, really. One, I am the HR director of a company called Penguin Random House. Random House, I think, is probably pretty well known in the US. Penguin, really well known in the UK. And so I do that as kind of my day job. And then from time to time, I also write a little bit and speak a little bit about kind of work and people and employment and various associated other things.
All right, so we got to get right into the what's keeping you up at night. What is what's top of mind for you these days?
Do you know, does it keep me up at night? Of course it does. But the thing for me is this, it's around simplicity. And the more I look at our workplace and the more I look at our organizations, I just can't help thinking that we've made it far too complicated, far too over-managed, over-processed, over-engineered. And if we are serious about creating great workplaces, then somehow we've got to get things simple again. And that how you do that and how you transfer that and how you take people on a journey that says, what's the least that we can do here, I think is the thing that's really on my mind.
So let me trot out an idea, and I want you to tear it apart. So I think that maybe our love of standards gets in the way of great HR. And what I mean by that is we should meet people where they are. So if somebody take some simple things, like we try to standardize everything. So every performance review is standardized. Everything is standardized. And it's our love of standards. It's good for us. It's good for HR pros, but I think it's bad for employees. And the reason I feel it's bad is that different people need to be onboarded different ways. You know, people, they have different learning styles, they have learning difficulties, there's all kinds of things that go on. Like a performance review, just between the three of us, I want my if you do a performance review that lasts more than 15 minutes, you've lost me. It doesn't matter how glorious it was, it doesn't matter how terrifying it was, 15 minutes, bubble it up, get to the point. What do I need to work on? And, telling me how wonderful I am, yeah, waste of your time. Get to the point. Tell me the things I need to shore up, and I'll go do that. So, and I'm not, and so Neil would be different, and Nisha would be different, but we apply in the middle of that, we apply some lame standard and then try to force it to make it work for Nisha, for Neil, and for William. Most of that is failure for all three of us because it doesn't meet us. It doesn't fit us. It's this cookie-cutter approach. So I'll shut up for a moment. What's your reaction to it? What do you think about that?
So this is one of my big kind of themes that I've been writing and speaking about recently is choice and our fear of providing choice in the workplace. And as you see generational differences and as we see organizations change, I think one of the challenges is how we create an organization that allows that choice, allows that individuality, allows people to manage their careers in a way that suits them, rather than the way we as an organization believe it should be. But what we try and do is, to your point, we standardize, but then we try and make the standardization so generic that it becomes so complex that nobody actually feels anything from it. It feels like you're being processed. I call it the HR sausage machine. You know, it's this constant chain. And, you know, the whole process of RPO and outsourcing and lean and centers of excellence have just made this 15 times worse than it needed to be. We've kind of idiotically and mindlessly walked towards kind of the lowest levels of performance that we could ever wish to instill in our organizations. And I think it's beholden on us to kind of stop and rethink how we do that and how we make organizations really fit for those individuals. So, yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I too totally agree. One size fits all won't work at all. But then, having said that individualization part, Neil, what do you foresee happening in the HR industry when it comes to the workforce are really expecting this kind of individualization from our end in order to, as you said in the beginning, making a simpler workplace, making it more simpler and letting them be who you are in the organization. So what are some of the challenges that can happen for the HR?
Well, I think part of it is letting go. So there's a real psychological mind shift that needs to take place. I don't know what other sort of mind shift you can do apart from a psychological one, but which is to say, you know, we don't need to control everything. We don't need to put everything within a process, that we can allow people to make grown-up decisions themselves rather than have to pass it through us. I think there's a really interesting piece about how we use technology and how we can use technology to facilitate people's choices, people's individuality. And I think there is a kind of balance that we need to get. You know, we can't forget that, we do live in regulatory environments, a balance of how we do that, but allow a level of equality as well. Because what we don't want to do is go back to the bad old days where, you know, some people have everything and some people have nothing. We're not talking about that. We're talking about a framework that allows people the same range of choices, but to individualize those to their needs. So I think the design becomes more complex, but the solution becomes simpler. So it's like this thing around, if you think about paper, if paper were created today, we'd find it the most incredible invention. You know, it's natural. Mm-hmm. You can grow it, you can recycle it, you can use it for a million different things. We think it's a very simple thing, but actually it's a pretty complex process. It's just one that's been around since the Egyptians or before. and I guess in our solutions, you know, it's exactly the same. They've got to feel simple and easy, but actually they're probably quite complex and hard to get to.
Well, in fact, what William said in the beginning is like for, and we look at the process from an HR point of view, it is pretty much simpler. But from an employee's perspective, it is pretty complex out there. So when it comes to HR interacting or expecting certain support from the line managers, what would you say, like when the workforce, now we have 5 generations in the workforce and going forward by 2020, people are expecting more of a millennial workforce at the workplace. So what do you expect from the line managers in order to support HR by being a mediator in order to customize the process in a way that employees are feeling comfortable in order to go through it?
So I think, in many ways, I think most line managers hate HR, and they're probably right to do so because we make them do things that they can't see or understand the point of. But the difficulty and I don't think it's not around generational management for me, because I think everyone is an individual. I think, you know, there's some thinking around, do you tier your interventions for generations? But then, you know, I might be very different to the next 40-year-old middle-class white guy. We might have different views. I think the difficulty for managers is it can seem incredibly daunting, the facilitation of a kind of individually managed organizations, because it's much easier to have a policy that you can hide behind and say, yeah, HR told me that you can't do this, and so, you know, that's the way it is. It's much harder to use your own kind of choice and your own judgment in making that. And so for me, the challenge for line managers is how do they facilitate, how do they tolerate that environment when actually a lot of burden will potentially be placed on their judgment rather than on relying on policies which on one hand they hate and despise, but on the other hand perhaps provide them with a safety blanket.
So Neil, I want to ask you a question about like what you like to hire. When you like to hire, what do you personally look for in the soft stuff, the adaptability and courage and passion, the soft stuff? Like, what do you look for? What's somebody, give me an idea of something that you really, really, really like in people that you hire.
I think passion for what we do is really important. I have this theory that, you know, most people come together to work 100% engaged, and then we just beat it out of them each day until we measure it at a lower level. So passion is really important. I think curiosity, in innovative, creative organizations, having that curiosity to question gently what we're doing and with a lightness of touch is really important. And I think the other part for me, and I know this sounds ridiculous, but it's a kind of levity, it's a sense of humor. And too much of what we do in the workplace, we get too serious about. And I can understand that if you're a heart surgeon or you're doing things that are, you know, life or death. But most of us aren't. And we don't bring enough humor and lightness to work in order to deal with that. So I think those sort of characteristics are the ones that really set people out for me above other candidates.
So do you ask specific things like a reading list or your favorite book that you've read or the last book you've read, or is it something so that you probe down into the, so that they're interested in what y'all do for a living? And y'all is a Texas phrase, by the way. But basically, do you kind of probe that to find out how disinterested they are in the what y'all do for a living?
Yeah. So one of our favorite questions is, what are you reading at the moment? And it's not necessarily because we care what they're reading at the moment, because we're a broad church. You know, if you want to read kind of deep philosophy, great. If you want to read, you know, James Patterson, great. If you want to read John Grisham, great. If you want to read E.L. James, great. You know, it's not really that. It's about, one, their hesitation, and two, how they talk about it. So you always know when someone rocks out one of the books that they read at school, and you think, oh, God, you haven't read a book since you were 18, have you? Because it's suddenly giving us one of the set texts from school. And, you know, you get a real sense. But it's not about, you know, kind of being sort of some judge of culture of what's good or what's bad. It's more about, you know, how quickly do you think about it because you know it, because you are reading, and how passionately do you talk about it? And that's important wherever you work for us. It's not just if you're in editorial. You know, my HR team are all great readers. They're all passionate about what we do, and it's just really important, because if you're going to be dealing with people who do that for a living, for a vocation, you might even say, then sharing their love is really important in influence, in all sorts of things.
Yeah, it's almost like the people that you've been traveling around talking to in the warehouses, they're hustling boxes of books back and forth. If they're dispassionate about books, you know, on some level it comes through in the work. So the fact that they could tell you what they're reading and maybe even delve into the characters and what they love or you know, how they're fighting through it, and everyone that reads, you fight through books sometimes. You know, you get to a place where you're like, why am I 180 pages into this? Why am I still reading this book? And you fight through it, and you get to the other side. So I love that. Let's pivot to the a question around culture fit and competence. I get asked this all the time, so now it's my turn to get to ask you. If you could only pick one candidate that's culturally, that fits your organization, that fits you, et cetera, versus someone that has the competence that's needed, that's required, and you really, you're pitting these things against each other. Like, you have to make decision of candidate A, more of a cultural fit, not a great on the competency. Candidate B, competency, higher, culture, not higher. Which one do you pick and why?
Okay, so can I have a caveat on this? The other factor remains neutral, not negative. Because obviously,
okay,
you know, someone could be a cultural fit but completely incompetent, and someone could be, you know, hugely competent but a complete psychopath. So assuming that the other side is roughly neutral, I think I'd go cultural fit. And the reason for that is that the competencies that we require in organizations and in the workplace are changing so fast that just because someone has them now doesn't mean they'll have what's required in 12 months' time, in 18 months' time, in 2 years' time. But someone who fits within the organization, who gets where you're going and wants to be part of it, is still likely to be able to adapt and to develop during that period of time. And so, you know, I think the idea that you hire for skills is great if you have a short-term project and you're willing to say, we will hire you and you come in and then you go, fine. But actually, the workforce of the future for me will be people who are adaptable, who can come in and who can transfer between roles, between functions, between departments, whatever that may be, and their career adapts within the organization rather than coming into a static role. So that's why I would always say culture over competence.
That's great. Well, in fact, hire for potential and adaptability. And while we were talking about culture fit and competency, I would say it is a 50-50 approach, right? So when talking about HR and recruiters, we would really appreciate if you can say, what have you seen? Do you think that HR and recruiters are equipped enough to identify the culture fit, first of all? If not, what do you recommend for them?
So, I'll talk from a UK perspective particularly. I think there's a lot of recruiters out there who can really get under the skin of the culture of an organization. I think too often, though, we revert to simple competency models or cultural models in order to do it within HR. And, you know, these are our values, and we'll look at it, but don't really get under the skin of the organization. And I don't think we're great at it. I think people are getting much better at it, and I think there's some really interesting kind of technology and solutions around as well that are that kind of really make you think about different ways of doing this. But we're still too fixated on, you know, how many years' experience have you got? Which school did you go to? You know, which software packages can you do? Because those are easy. And they kind of, you know, they make it easier for us to select, where some of the other things, again, are probably a little bit harder, but a hell of a lot more appropriate and a hell of a lot more valuable.
All right. Now let's do a segue to HR and marketing. Because we always say that as HR is evolving, we can see that HR is using some of the marketing techniques, like using big data or data analysis to predict the future needs of human capital and marketing skills to do employer branding and recruitment marketing and stuff like that. So what do you see? Do you see HR is getting into a marketing role, or HR is pretty much unique as who we are?
I think HR is unique, but I think it should learn and constantly look at other disciplines and understand what they can learn from them. And I don't think that's just marketing. I mean, the piece about branding, absolutely. You know, if you've got brand marketeers, they're going to really understand this. But they also need to understand that you're selling an organization, not a product. And those are very different things. The piece around big data, this really worries me. And I think this is the latest stupid trend within HR, if I'm honest, because if you've got customers or consumers, you can collect much more data about them, and they are willing to give you much more data than employees are. And I think rightfully so. You know, I don't want anyone analyzing how much time I spend in the coffee room or on the toilet, or you know, I don't want people to know what my workflow through my walking through the building is. But those are all the things that retailers can use and analyze. And I think we've got to be slightly careful that, you know, we started this conversation talking about individuality. You know, my concern about big data is that it actually tries to distill everything into patterns. And I think it's neither one nor the other. It's understanding that, yeah, there will be some trends and we should understand those, but also, you know, people are individuals. So for me, you know, yes, we can learn a lot from marketing, but it's not the same. I think the biggest thing we can learn is the mindset. And marketeers will always say the customer is king. And yet in HR, we don't think the employee is king. In fact, actually quite often we feel the opposite. They get in the way of us doing good HR management. And if we're serious about individuality and simplicity, and if we're serious about creating compelling workplaces, we've got to treat the employee as if they're the king, our customer. And that doesn't mean they always get what they want, but it means we present the information to them in compelling ways, we communicate with them in clear forms, and we think about their needs when we're designing whatever our interventions and our products are. And that for me is where the overlap is. I think it's very nice for generally recruiters to go, oh yeah, we should merge HR with marketing. But you know, I've spent most of this year working on compensation and benefits and very, very complex remuneration issues. I don't think those competencies sit within marketing. And so we need to be careful that we don't draw simple associations, but I do think we can learn a lot.
So we'd be remiss if we didn't ask you about some of the idiosyncratic stuff that happens in British HR. You travel the world. I know that because I keep up with you. And I know that, you know, just the UK versus the rest of Europe, not even dealing with the rest of the world, there are things that are truly unique about HR that happens there. What are some of those things for the Americans that are listening? What are some of those things that we should be aware of?
So, I mean, the UK is kind of somewhere between the US and Europe, and it has this weird mix of, you know, we're probably less regulated and less prescribed than many of our European cousins. But we also have European legislation that applies to us. And so we have always have this kind of slight weird tension between very free market mindset in many areas and yet many quite regulated approaches in other areas. I think that then drives a kind of quite often a schizophrenic approach where we'll apply things like, you know, we have the Working Time Directive that limits the number of hours per week that people can work and the breaks that they need to take and things like that. But at the same time, we have pretty free flow on compensation or union membership, for example. So it's a weird hybrid. And, you know, my American colleagues are always quite surprised at how complicated it is to fire someone in the UK. And yet my kind of Central European colleagues always surprised at how easy it is to fire someone in the UK. So we have this weird kind of mongrel-like approach to HR, which makes it, I think, makes it quite hard for people to work here from different kind of countries. But, you know, good people can do it. You just need to take time to think and understand the individual needs.
That's great. Well, Neil, we have about 4 minutes left at this point, and my last question would be, you know, we call ourselves, I mean, HR, as change agents, right? And this interesting question why I asked you is, like, I've gone through your blog, and your blog's name is Change Effect. So I thought, yeah, I should definitely ask this question to you. How can HR function better equipped to lead the change?
So that starts with listening. And it starts with feeling the organization. So too often, too much HR management is done from the HR function without really feeling the organization. And if you want to successfully navigate change, you need to sense it, feel it, and absorb it completely, because then intuitively you'll make the right leadership decisions and the right management decisions to help people to transition. Whereas when you see only a small part, then what often seems like a simple solution can cause more damage within the organization or lead to resistance. And that for me is one of the big pieces. I think I honestly believe that HR is probably the only function that has a view of the entire organization and all the buttons and levers to press and to turn in order to make change happen. But so often they don't understand exactly what those buttons and levers are, because they don't get involved in the organization enough to feel them, and two, they don't stand back enough in order to take the entire organizational approach, because they get too tied into specific initiatives or delivery and too granular and micro and not macro enough. And so I think that the really getting ingrained within the organization, and that's just talking to people and listening and understanding and feeling and not jumping to conclusions, and then understanding how that all connects are the real challenges. We don't have enough engineers and scientists in HR. We have too many arts people. And, you know, engineers and scientists understand systems, and they understand systemic thinking. And when you do that, you understand how you make change work, because our organizations are systems, and thinking like that is perhaps the biggest challenge.
Wonderful. So we have got 2 more minutes. I want to use that. Do you see going forward HR is becoming more of a specialist than a generalist?
I think it's splitting into two, to be completely honest. I think that increasingly we're seeing some very deep specialist roles within HR. And I think those, you know, things like compensation, if we're really serious about compensation, that is a really specialist role. And it requires deep, deep technical knowledge. And I believe the same exists for learning and development, for example. But I also think that there are big chunks of generalist relationship management, if you like, which require completely different sets of skills. It's almost the difference between, if you take sales, between, you know, account management and you know, kind of key account management, or relationship management and key account management. They're real differences. So we're a broad church, but I think there's room for specialism and generalism within it.
Great. Well, Neil, thank you so much for joining with us. And where can people connect with you and get a hold of you?
So at Twitter, I'm at Neil Morrison. The blog is www.changeeffect.com. And there's contact details and emails and all sorts of things. And LinkedIn, I'm Neil Morrison.
All right. So thank you so much for joining us again, and wish you all a wonderful rest of the week.
Thanks, Neil.
Thanks, William. Bye-bye.
Bye.